Is consumerism our secret religion? Does alienation lie behind our medical problems? Are fairy tales really true? Do most people live in reality or under a spell? Want to hear more? Stay tuned. Welcome to InnerVision. I'm Dr. Nita Valens. InnerVision is your Tuesday lunchtime spot for health and spirituality. What is your vision for yourself? The information you hear today is designed to challenge and inspire you. I invite you to listen with an open mind, use what you learn to further having a life you love and giving back to others. My guest today says, quote, "Does our epidemic of depression reflect our animosity toward ourselves?" End quote. Dr. Bud Harris has over 30 years' experience as a practicing psychotherapist, psychologist, and Jungian analyst. He defines himself as a husband, a father, a grandfather, psychologist, and Jungian analyst, and did his postdoctoral work at C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich. Early in his life, he earned a bachelor's degree in management from Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia. After Tech, Bud became a businessman and then owned his own business, which he operated successfully. But then, in spite of his achievements, he found his life in the cul-de-sac that he explains in his latest book, his fourth, and our topic today, Sacred Selfishness. Welcome to InnerVision on KPFK, Dr. Harris.
Thank you, Nita. I'm delighted to be here.
We're delighted to have you. Sacred Selfishness is subtitled, A Guide to Living a Life of Substance. So we can infer from the introduction that you were living a pretty good life, but then you kind of hit a bump in the road and it wasn't the life you thought. You want to tell us your story a little bit?
Sure, I would like to do that. And actually, I tell most of this story in the opening of the book. I was living a very good life, but it was not a life of substance. When I was 33 years old, a young man, I was married, I had three children, and I owned 12 stores in Atlanta, Georgia. If you had asked me about myself, I would have told you that I was a unique person creating their own destiny. But underneath that facade was a growing depression and a crumbling marriage. Now, another interesting thing is that if you had asked me if I loved myself, I would have looked at you kind of funny for asking such a ridiculous question and said, of course. Now, the truth is that I didn't know what that question really meant. I didn't know what it meant to love oneself. I didn't know that you couldn't love someone that you don't really know, especially if that person is yourself. The other thing I didn't realize was that I was not living a unique life. I was living a life that had been created by the effects of the culture, my family, the education and religious institutions that I grew up in, and the successes and failures and traumas of my childhood. What my depression was really trying to tell me was that I was an actor in a play, and I didn't know who had written the script.
Wow, well said. An actor in a play, and you didn't know who had written the script. That's a great way of saying it, because it's like you're waking up wondering who you are, in a sense.
I was having a hard time waking up. That's why I was depressed. I needed to get help to wake up. And I was lucky enough when I started looking for help to find a therapist that understood that I didn't need fixing so I could get right back on the wrong road. I needed to go deeper inside myself and try to figure out what my life was really about. What were my deepest feelings? What were my deepest dreams? What were my hopes? What would help me really love myself, love life, and be able to love other people in a positive, enriching way? And to be honest with you, that took 2 or 3 years of digging and inner work. It didn't come easily, but in the long run, it became something that was actually miraculous in my own mind.
So did you go into what we call sort of classic Jungian analysis? Is that what you did first, or did you go to marital counseling? How did you start out on your path?
No, I have to admit, you know, at my age, there were not that many Jungian analysts around in the South when I was 33. So I went first to classic marital counseling, found that was not really helping me very much, And then I shopped for a therapist and eventually found one that I clicked with that I felt like was as concerned with spiritual values and the philosophy of life as he was in fixing problems. And it was a real grace to be able to find someone like that.
So do you think we should sidebar for a moment and explain to the audience the difference between psychotherapy and sort of classic analysis a little bit? Because some people really still today don't know that. And psychotherapists in general and even analysts work in different ways. So we're not trying to sort of like lump everybody into a category, but maybe say a few words about the differences.
Sure. Most people who come to see me think of classical analysis really as being more Freudian oriented than Jungian. Jungian analysis is a very diverse approach to analysis. Many analysts are quite different. Some consider themselves classical. Some consider themselves generalist. I think Dr. Jung considered himself a generalist, and his idea was to work with people where they are, on what they were bringing, and trying to find out how that was directing them toward discovering the meaning in their life and how their life needed to grow and transform. So from that standpoint, our symptoms are not something that we want to just get rid of. We want to understand them. We want to understand the directions they're trying to turn us toward. We want to see if there's any possibility that they can become inner teachers.
So then the goal is, in analysis, is deeper understanding?
The goal in analysis, the way that I understand it in practice, it is deeper understanding, but deeper understanding that leads one to transform their life so that the life becomes more fulfilling, so that it becomes more of an expression of the love that we're capable of both giving and receiving.
So the ultimate goal is transformation.
Absolutely.
Because that's what I say my goal is as a psychotherapist. On my website, I have an opening line that says, "Welcome to the transformation zone."
Very good, because as you know, transformation really needs to become a way of life. That's what a life that grows really is about.
Do you find that in your work that even though you made the change in your life that you needed to do, you went inside and found what would make you happy, do you find that in your work you still, it's not like you hit that plateau and said, "Ah, okay, I'm here, I'm happy." You still are growing and moving all the time.
Absolutely. That's the process of being alive. And as long as we're fully alive, we will be growing and transforming. For example, I originally went back to school to become a psychologist and a psychotherapist. I'd never heard of Jung. It was later that I discovered Jung and became a Jungian analyst. It was later in that journey that I discovered writing and took up that as a new avocation. And then I took up teaching. So different things happen as we go along, and we need to be open all the time. The big advantage to really knowing yourself well is, and to knowing the process of transformation, is that you don't fear change because you're not stuck in who you think you are or how you think life should be. You're open to the adventure. You're even open to the suffering that comes because all life brings suffering with it. And we look for transformation even in that.
Well, yes, we have a lot to say about suffering today. I'm speaking with Dr. Bud Harris, author of Sacred Selfishness. So you then got into, you made a connection with a therapist, and you began, what happened after that? Your first marriage dissolved, I assume.
What happened after that was that I spent about 3 years in therapy, working very intensely, trying to uncover the life that I hadn't discovered that I had been living for 33 years. And what that life meant, where it wanted to go. As a result of that, I decided to sell my businesses and to go back to school and to study psychology, to study something I really wanted to study because I never studied anything that I really wanted to study. I'd always studied what would get me somewhere. Yes, my marriage, in fact, did fall apart at that time. It was too many changes, too much stress.
Well, that happens a lot. And what is interesting about what you're saying also that I want to delve into is that you had never studied anything that you wanted to study. So the fact that you had gone to Georgia Tech, that you had opened all these stores, That was a script that was coming down from your family of origin?
That was a script that came from my family. It came from the culture to be successful, to be able to make enough money to do well, to have a respected place in the community. And I was able to achieve those things, and then I found out that they weren't really satisfying me. They weren't really fulfilling. It's a tough script to have to deal with because our culture has a mindset about what is a good life, what is a successful life, and it doesn't teach us to really look inside and see what that means for us personally.
That is so true. So that really brings us back to the title of your book, Sacred Selfishness. Let's let you define what you mean by sacred selfishness as opposed to what we usually connotate as being selfish in our culture.
Sure. It's a wonderful term, sacred selfishness. I've had a lot of fun with it. It's the title of the book. Few people are shocked by it, but most people love it because they never have thought of that dimension of selfishness. Now, of course, there is what I call sickly selfishness, as I defined the two kinds of selfishness early in the book. Sickly selfishness is what we were taught not to be all of our life, that is, egocentric, using other people for our own benefits, being demanding, and that sort of thing. Sacred selfishness is exactly the opposite pole from that. Sacred selfishness is having the commitment to create a life of substance, a personality of substance for ourselves, having a commitment to do the reflection, to do the thinking, to develop the insight that we need to have to be most fully who we are. And sacred selfishness leads us onto a path that eventually ends up with us empowering all of the people around us. We're anything but selfish once we get to that point.
So to really follow the sacred selfishness path, we have to do a task that you call in the book individuation, the individuation process, which is really getting to know ourselves and going within. Talk about individuation.
Individuation is Dr. Jung's term for a life that's committed to self-realization, to developing our own consciousness, to developing self-knowledge, and to pursuing becoming authentic people through that process. It comes from reflecting on our lives. It comes from listening to our dreams. It comes from seeing how we affect other people. And in the book, actually, I devote three different chapters to techniques for that. One is on befriending dreams, one is on journaling, and one is on inner dialoguing, or what Jung called active imagination. And those have actually become religious practices for me. And I define, actually, a religious practice as something that transforms my life. If it doesn't transform my life, then it's not really a spiritual practice as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's a great that's a great sort of measuring tool in the mm-hmm. sense that if it's not transforming us, it's not helpful.
It's not helpful, nor is it spiritual to me, because with that kind of work, at that point, spirituality and psychology come together.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up spirituality, because you talk a lot about religion in the book and how the departure of being involved with religious institutions in our culture has caused for many people sort of an alienation that goes on within us. And I was wondering if, because of the sort of growth in spirituality and spiritual ideas, say in the last decade or two, if you feel that has taken up some of that slack left by people not being involved in religious institutions, or if you feel like there's still a big gap.
I think the growth in spirituality in the last decade has been wonderful. I think it's part of a cultural transformation that is needed to take place probably for over a century. I think it's taking place outside of religious institutions for the simple reason that most of the institutions are too stuck in their past and in their identity that they have defined for themselves to be able to make the transformation necessary to go on into the kind of spirituality that people today need to have, the kind of spirituality that can really help guide and develop our lives.
So how does one know when one is on the path, so to speak? How does one know when, how can you know when, How do you teach people about how to know when you're in the transformation zone, so to speak?
I don't teach people how to know when they're in the transformation zone. I teach people to develop self-knowledge, to pay attention to their dreams, through journaling, to pay attention to the feelings they're having, the way life is affecting them, the way their life is developing, to pay attention to the symptoms they might have or the hopes and dreams they might have or the creativity they might have that they're not really living into, and to dialogue with those things. And if we pay enough attention to developing self-knowledge, if we pay enough attention to trying to become authentic people, we will live into the transformations very rapidly.
Do you think that we have enough support for spirituality in our society yet?
No, I don't think we have enough support at all, particularly for individual growth and development. There's no question that once we start on our own path that we threaten everyone around us.
Yes.
The people that will be trying as hard as they can to get us back to what they consider normal will be the people who are supposed to love us the most. And normally they don't support our change. So there's a certain price that we pay in loneliness for a while until we get used to it and until they get used to us and see what we're doing is not threatening in the way they thought it would be. The only way it's threatening is that it threatens their own definition of what normal should be and what a good life should be.
Sometimes I wonder if it isn't that, as you referred to a minute ago, that the spirituality is causing, sort of, you could say, planetary shifts mm-hmm. and growth. And those people that strike out individually on different paths, sort of marching, what we used to call marching to the tune of their own drummer, then challenge in all of these different individual families all across the land.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all of the generations have been drifting down, doing all these things that the previous generation is expecting, so that as the next generation, we follow these expectations, and then we hit this crisis, which used to be called the existential crisis, that we say, oh, well, whose life am I living? So then don't we, at the level of transformation that we have in this generation, doesn't that sort of honor backwards into the previous generations as well as create something new and fresh for following generations?
Oh, yes, I think it does both. It honors backwards and it creates something new and fresh for future generations. And it also creates a very fulfilling life for ourselves in the present. And it helps us set up a model of a way to live that's based on transformation and self-knowledge that can do nothing but empower the generation that's coming behind us. And it also, the further we go into looking at that, we realize some of the value of the past generation, too. They didn't just do everything wrong, even though they may have been very limiting to us. They also had their own courage, their own struggles, their own suffering, and their own ways of finding joy.
I'm speaking with Dr. Bud Harris, author of Sacred Selfishness, subtitled A Guide to Living a Life of Substance. So basically, we have all these influences of the family. We have all these influences of society that are going on, and it would be very easy in a sense to keep in the, living life in those expectations of everyone, but so many people, it seems like in the last generation or two, are saying, no, I'm not going to do that. And more people are striking out on their own individual paths. So when the trilogy of things that you have people do, the dream work, the journaling, and
the active imagination, the dialoguing.
The active imagination. So these tools, which are so valuable and necessary to sort of get one over the hump, so to speak, how can people get started with these things? And yet it's tricky to find support for that. And to keep going, even though hitting those rough spots and hitting like the suffering, mentioned, the loneliness, sometimes the alienation.
Well, it depends on the spot that you're beginning. If you're feeling depressed and restless and blocked, certainly reading the book will give you the tools for starting the kind of journaling that I talk about, which is really a dialogue with your life. It's not so simply a diary where you note the events. But to do the journaling and to look at your dreams, all of that is in the book. There's three chapters devoted to it, and it fits within the context of a whole story. If you were like I was and your situation was a little bit more serious and you have a depression that's really getting pretty hard on you, then you need to find the right person to help you, the right professional person. And the only way I know to do that is to go meet a few of them and to interview them and to ask them what they think of this book, what they think of Jungian psychology, what they think of transformation, what they think of personal growth.
Set up your own little support group there. What one of the delightful things in Sacred Selfishness is you talk about myths, and one of the myths that is one of your favorites, I believe, was the story of Abraham.
Yes, Abraham is not exactly a myth. It's a story from the Bible that I think has the same archetypal validity as a myth. And I like that story because Abraham had to leave his father's house, which means he had to leave his father's values, his father's culture, his father's security, much as I did, because I had to leave the values of my father and my mother when I decided to sell my business. And in fact, my parents thought I was a little bit crazy at the time. And then I became a psychologist and had a clinic that was also fairly successful, and I decided to sell that and go to Zurich and study to be an analyst, and they were pretty well convinced I'd gone over the edge.
So that's just as they get used to you being a psychologist, you decide, oh, well.
Here's the next step.
Turn left going to Kansas again.
That's right.
So that was an adjustment for your family, but I bet by the time you went to Zurich, they must have just figured out that, you know, whatever if you're pursuing your passion, you're going to achieve success and be happier. So they must have been witnessing the changes in you all along and eventually come to the party, did they?
They witnessed the changes and they began to have a certain amount of respect for the courage that it took and the things that I was accomplishing. I don't think they ever exactly came to the party. They were still a little bit skeptical. And particularly from the standpoint that they worried that if I'm in analysis, I'm probably talking about them, which really wasn't true in that sense.
Well, exactly. Who knows what gets discussed, you know? Mm-hmm. But when you talk a lot about quoting many of the great modern thinkers that that addressed despair in modern life, like Kierkegaard and Erich Fromm and lots of people that discuss loneliness and alienation, but it's kind of a new concept. Not a new concept, but there's kind of a new level of acceptance, I feel, in recent years for the idea that loneliness and alienation can be a direct cause of illness. And maybe the way was paved by Hans Selye's work on stress and other people that have come along. Talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. They are a direct cause of illness. They're a direct cause of other things, too, Erich Fromm pointed out. Terrorism, for example, is a cause by alienation. So is mass murdering. There are a lot of very ill things that come if we become alienated enough from ourselves. And I was quite sure that if I didn't make some major changes in my life, that I would be facing a heart attack by the time I was 40. And I think the research since has borne up that was pretty good thinking. That's probably true. There is nothing that is more healthy, as far as I'm concerned, that is living a life that's committed to self-knowledge, that's committed to being authentic, that is committed toward transforming ourselves into being the most complete human being that we can be, the kind of human being that brings all of their aspects into a sense of wholeness.
Do you believe in the essential good nature of man in the big picture? So, in other words, I guess what I'm really asking is, do you believe then that everyone can have the experience of transformation and of living out of a genuine self?
Yes, I do. And I believe that transformation is part of the archetypal basis of the human psyche. In other words, it's natural force. We're going to live it whether we like it or not. The question is, are we going to cooperate with it and help it develop us, or are we going to rigidify and are we going to fight it? Or are we going to be too wounded or too scared to face it in some way? I believe that there is a pattern in every human being that wants them to grow to their fullest expression. I think there are many things that can happen to human beings that can thwart that pattern.
What do you think? I'm sure you've met many people, probably not, that come to your office, because assuming people that come to your office are open to change and growth and such, but I've met many people, and you probably have too, that are feel like they're just kind of asleep, shut down, maybe involved mm-hmm. in addictions. And how do you think we as clinicians or even just concerned people walking the planet can reach people that seem very, very shut off and shut down?
Well, there are two ways we can approach that. And Jung's primary focus was to work with one person at a time, feeling that each person that becomes authentic, each person that grows in consciousness, each person that becomes increasingly enlightened will affect the people around them, will empower them, and will help bring them further in their life. And I support that approach primarily. There are other things that we can do, too. We can teach, we can write, and we can live in a way that expresses inner integrity in the way that we handle our social duties, and we can be compassionate. And I think anyone that becomes enlightened has to become compassionate. Compassion is the main way that we learn to go beyond ourselves.
I have noticed just in the last couple of years in my life that if I lose compassion, it's a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Without compassion for anybody in any place, that then comes back in that judging, making mm-hmm. judgments. Or being critical, and that's a big energy drain, I feel.
It's a particularly big energy drain because what we don't realize is that when we're not compassionate with other people, we're not compassionate with ourselves either. And that's the big one, because we're less compassionate with ourselves generally than we are for others.
That's really very well said. I love that. One of the themes of this show is to continue in reemphasizing compassion and concern about other people and concern about ourselves. That's sort of an ongoing theme of the years of doing this show. Probably mm-hmm. the other hosts would agree with that. I wanted to let you have a chance to talk about the bluebird. Bluebeard.
Yes.
I always say bluebird when I want to say bluebeard. I'm picturing Bluebeard and saying Bluebeard. Anyway, the myth of Bluebeard, that was pretty powerful.
The fairy tale of Bluebeard, yes. And you threw me a little bit with the Bluebird.
Yes. I threw myself, too.
So we had just visited Capistrano, and so I was thinking, uh-oh. One of my favorite fairy tales, and as most people will remember from childhood, it's about a woman who is married for money, for prestige, for power, and she goes on to discover that that's a very deadly mistake. And she discovers that it's also caused other women to be murdered. And what the fairy tale is really talking about is how we murder ourselves when we do things for the wrong values. And it gives us a little guideline of how we can look at that, we can understand it, and then we can help ourselves get out of it. Because in the end, once she becomes conscious, she finds the way to get out of it. Her brother helps her. She kills Bluebeard, or he kills Bluebeard. And she ends up with the riches in a healthy way. And that's what we're looking for, is how to build a rich, fulfilling life, but one that's based on our own truth and not what the culture has tried to tell us to do. You know, I point out in the book, and it's one of my favorite things that Eric Fromm said, he talks about the culture as having its own social character, and the culture wants to get everyone to live up to that so it will do the things society needs to survive, which in our society is to consume. And he goes on to talk about the psychopathology of normalcy. And I love that term because normalcy is psychopathological. It is one-sided. It's never connected to the personal. And if we try to be normal, we can never really be ourselves.
Well, there's no definition of normal, is there? I mean, what does that mean? I mean,
well, normal is really a statistical definition, which we're all an exception to, but we need to realize that we're an exception to it and that we don't want to try to live up to it.
Ah. Well, we have much more to talk about, and we're going to let you join our conversation if you wish to on 818-985-5735. Here on InnerVision, I'm speaking with Bud Harris. Jungian analyst and author of Sacred Selfishness, A Guide to Living a Life of Substance. This has been endorsed by Julia Cameron, author of The Artist's Way. Bud Harris is a lantern on the path, clear-eyed, big-hearted, and illuminating. That's Julia Cameron, author of The Artist's Way. This is Inner Vision. I'm your host, Nita Valens. This is KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. We're going to be back in just a moment with your calls. KPFK is the number to call if you would like to ask Dr. Bud Harris a question. We're talking about Sacred Selfishness, his new book, and his fourth. And we're going to start with Sandra in Sherman Oaks. And as I call your name, please turn your radio down right before I put you on the air so we don't echo. Thanks a lot. I appreciate that. Hi, Sandra. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to you, Ms. Allen. I've been listening to KPFK for just centuries, and I want to thank you for having Mr. Harris on. My question is, first, what sign is he?
What astrological sign?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, Sandra, I'm a Virgo, of course, in my profession, and Leo is my rising sign.
Oh, yeah, you had to have Leo in summer with all that love. I want to thank you for your beautiful thoughts. I have never on KPFK or anywhere else heard anybody quite as clear and pure as you are, and it's absolutely a breath of fresh air. I just can't get over it. Everything you said was so perfectly pure and clear and right on, and if people could relate to that, we would really be in a state of bliss at this moment and probably state of heaven. So I just wanted to thank you and Ms. Allen for being together today, and I'd certainly like to hear more of you. Do you practice in Los Angeles?
No, I practice in Asheville, North Carolina.
However, but Sandra, yes. Do not despair, because if you go to budharris.com, you'll see that Dr. Harris is going to be in town for a while, mostly in the Orange County area, speaking at some different venues, and different things are going on. So you can still catch him, and he does come out here periodically and speak at the Jungian Center of Los Angeles. And also on budharris.com is a resource section that gives the listings of all the different places, and you can click on those sites also and see what's going on. So thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra.
And I wanted to also let the listener know that one of the things I appreciate, it was someone just like Sandra who was hearing the show and told me about you, actually. I won't say who it was because I don't have her permission to give her name, but we're all very grateful.
Please thank her for me.
I will. Well, she's probably listening. So we're going to James in Ventura. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
And it's great that you have Dr. Harris. Just real quick. I am a Chicano. I marched with Chavez. I was involved in the labor movement. I'm an artist at heart. And went to college, and my family pushed me to go to law school. I was going to go to film school. And married this lovely Jewish woman, and she's and her family are insistent that I, you know, pass the bar and become this great big lawyer and stuff. And I'm just starting to doubt whether that's what I really wanted to do versus continuing my work in social justice and the arts, and I'm just finding myself at a crossroads. I'm a Gemini, and I have two yodes in my astrology, if that helps.
Well, thank you, James. I had quite a few years of social justice in my own background, and I still find a piece of my heart is there. The only way that I know to settle the kind of dilemma that you're in is to make the commitment to really getting to know yourself at a deeper level, to getting to know your unconscious, to getting to know more about your dreams, to do a bit of journaling, to follow the practices that I talk about in the book. Because I found out that when I'm in a dilemma like that, it's not an answer that I can make the right decision on. I have to go deeper into myself and find out what I really am thinking about in my heart, what is really important to me, and to then live into an answer that comes from that.
Okay.
Is that helpful, James?
It is. But
clear as mud?
It's kind of vague because I'd like specifics on how I could delve deeper into my conscience.
Well, I would give you specifics in that. If in the book, Sacred Selfishness, I have the whole book is devoted to that. And then there are three specific chapters on the practices that I'm talking about that give you a step-by-step direction as to how to do those. Unfortunately, it's just more than I can really explain in depth on the radio.
I understand. Well, I'm going to go. You sold me on the book.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good luck, James. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. One of the things that we want to do is also bring into the conversation relationships.
Yes, it's a wonderful topic today because almost everyone is struggling with their relationships. You know, we're going through an era of vast change, a time of change where relationships get very little support in many ways. It's also a time when we expect more from our relationships than people ever did in the past. I found that people are looking for love, for affirmation, for security, for sexuality, for a whole host of those kind of things. And yet we're also finding that the relationship is the place where we are experiencing most of our anger, our frustration, our heartache, and they're the crucible for the negative things as well. The only way out of that, or the only way through that, that really makes sense to me is what I have talked about earlier. And that is that we have to go far enough into ourselves to where we possess the capacity to love ourselves. If we have really developed the kind of self-love that we need, we are self-affirming. And then we find that the love that we give and the love that we receive is always a gift. It's not something that's trying to fulfill a need. It's not us giving ourselves away in order to try to get some other needs fulfilled. It becomes truly a gift at that point. And I think that we live in an era where people are living longer. We have to have relationships that continually evolve. And the only real way that we can do it is to have it become based on self-love and self-knowledge as a foundation.
Well said. I'm speaking with Bud Harris, author of Sacred Selfishness. We're taking your calls on 818-985-5735. We're going back to the phones. I'm looking for Alexander in Ventura, and there you are. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I just had a question. I was in a relationship also for 5 years, and I wound up ending it for reasons that I thought were good enough that I didn't want both of us to go on and, like, just keep on arguing a lot and stuff like that. And I mean, After ending it, I still felt a lot of attraction for this person, but I ended it because of certain reasons. Like I said, I didn't want to be, like, more torment than it was a good time. So, but, like, I still have, like, resentment towards myself and, like, me doing this. I mean, should I not feel resentful because it seems like it was the right thing, or should I have just, like, really tried more or something?
I think you're in a problem, Alexander, that many people are experiencing today. And I think the way through it is for you to look at it in terms of what you think you need to learn from this whole experience. How is this relationship set up by your own psyche to be a teacher for you into how to develop yourself and expand your own personality? For one thing, you know, I would begin to feel like it's teaching you that you need to learn how to affirm yourself better, how to deepen your own self-respect. And that is the approach that I would take to working with it. Certainly resentment is always a sign to me that I've expected someone to fill a need that I need to learn how to fill for myself.
Also, I'm wondering if when you say resentment, if you had the idea that you ended it impulsively or you ended it too soon or without giving it a chance. Is that part of what's going on?
No, not at all. Not giving enough of a chance because, I mean, I gave it plenty of chances. Uh-huh. I gave it actually another year or two just to give the chances and stuff like that. We both did. But in the end, to me, I just realized that, you know, there are certain aspects of my life that weren't going to be fulfilled in the end after these 5 years. No changes in what the ideas were supposed to be that. It was just one of those things. It's like if you really love this person and you're sick, you don't want to get them sick, so you might as well step away for a while or something like that. But, you know, it seems like the right thing, but it hurts and it leaves me in a place where I feel real lonely right now, you know. So that was my thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And, you know, I think that it was a torturous situation for you. And the best thing for you to do at that point is to realize that You have to strengthen the relationship with yourself. You have to find out more about who you are.
Okay.
Good luck with that. All right. Take care, Alexander. Thanks for your call, and thanks for sharing your story. We're going to Nene in Newport Beach, and there you are. Hi, Nene.
Hi. I'm not sure if I heard it right when he said that when you feel alienated and when you feel lonely, the reason can be some type of a sickness. Is that how he said it, or does it
the other way around? Actually, it was the other way around, because we were talking about, does alienation cause disease?
Okay.
So does that answer?
Okay. And does it explain in the book in detail exactly about this?
Well, there is some information in the book about it, but do you want to comment on that?
Yes, there is information in the book about it, and there is information about the different kind of loneliness that we experience at different points in our life. And I certainly think that when we're talking about alienation causing disease, we're talking about really being alienated from our true self, really from the heart of who we are.
Oh, okay. Now I understand.
Okay.
Thanks for your call. Okay. We're going to move to Maria Elena in Hollywood. If I can find you, there you are. Hi, welcome to the show, Maria Elena.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for a wonderful show and all the great programming on KPFK.
You're welcome.
And my question is, what is a good way to make a decision with regard to very basic material needs? And I'm talking about housing, myself being a teacher and an artist, and in a housing market in Los Angeles that's so competitive, and always hearing these messages about, you know, you have to do it, and you have to buy, and you have to buy now, and you can make money off your house, and or, you know, off of renting. You know, all these messages I'm getting that make me feel really pressured, and but I don't feel that they're genuine, you know, from me. So, and I've been thinking about this for a while, and I've come to some conclusions that I don't, you know, that I, it does make sense for me to do this long term, because I need a place. I need a place to live long term. And especially when I'm elderly and retired, and but I don't want to do it in the traditional way. I'm a single woman, and I want to buy with a friend and have a big, huge, I don't know, like craftsman style where
mm-hmm.
I can live.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's still, but it's just an idea now, and that's how far I've gotten. But I think in general that's a tough one, you know, when you're feeling these pressures and, in fact, frivolous things that, you know, their actual needs that we do have as human beings.
Sure. And I'll thank you for your question. And again, it's one that we all get caught in. I was certainly caught in it. And I can't advise you in your own case, but I will try to make some comments from my own experience. Certainly, conventional wisdom tells us we need to do many of those things. And if we live in a conventional way, conventional wisdom is correct. When I sold my business and went back to school, you know, I sold something that was paying me well, that gave me an upper middle class standard of living and all of that stuff to take a chance for something new. When I went to Zurich to study, I had to cash in my retirement fund, which just scandalized my parents. They said, what are you going to do when you get old? What are you going to do when you're 65? Well, I have to tell you, now I'm 67 and I still don't have a retirement fund, and I'm living and enjoying life and having a really great time. So you have to make your own decision as to what is going to diminish your life and what is going to enrich your life. And I try not to let conventional wisdom keep me from fulfilling my life. I also understand very well that I have to have a place to live and clothes to wear and food to eat. We have to take care of those practicalities no matter how idealistic we are. And that's just a fact of life. And I do that, but I want to do it in a way that doesn't diminish me.
Well, is that working for you, Maria Elena?
Yeah, that was great. I really appreciate hearing it from your personal perspective. That's really helpful.
You know, it's really, you know, you're right. We live in a tough housing market here, so it's a tough call, because it's a big hunk of change to get into a commitment like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just urge you to, you know, I think you have a great dream there with that, with, mm-hmm. you know, what you described, and I would urge you to really start talking to people and see what you can find, because I bet you can create that.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And I think that it's a matter of, mm-hmm. Connecting up with the right people who would help you get that going on.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I do too.
So good luck with that. Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks. Okay, we're going to go back to the calls in a moment, but first we have a question from someone who couldn't stay on the line. A caller wants to know how to encourage an older person who's about 76 to find a purpose in life or how he can go about it.
You know, I will have to share with you that I've worked with a number of older people, some in their 80s in analysis. I know one woman who was 78 who had her own spiritual conversion at that age. And I have found that the soul of each of us, which means the unconscious and the psyche, whichever you would like to call it, wants to live and wants to grow and wants to expand no matter how old we are. And the same thing works for older people as works for people that are in their middle age. That is to pay attention to their dreams. That is to pay attention to their life and their feelings and to journal and study it carefully. Is to dialogue with the parts in themselves that would like to come to life or the parts of themselves that are threatening to them. The psyche is still intact no matter how old we are and as long as our health holds out. And I think there's no reason why older people shouldn't enjoy that. One of the most exciting groups I ever did was a group, was a dream group with people who were in their 80s. And they just really taught me more about living than I taught them.
I would also add to that that in our, some people, it's true that in our culture we don't revere older people. Mm-hmm. And some people who maybe are widowed or widower and feel lonely having lost a spouse and children that have grown up and gone away, or maybe elderly people who are alone and never had children or don't feel real connected in the community, feel sort of thrown away by the culture. So I think it makes it more difficult. So there are senior citizen centers and places around. If you check in the community, sometimes YMCAs have special things going on for seniors. And try and get, because I have a few clients mm-hmm. in that age group, and I try and get them a little bit linked up with community resources that helps them feel not so alienated and alone and helps them get back to being able to do that individual work.
So it's also good, I think, to help them reframe their situation. Many of them mm-hmm. do feel thrown away by a culture that focuses on youth. From a spiritual standpoint, that's a real advantage because to be thrown away by the culture puts you out exactly where most of the mystics had to fight to be, which is outside of the culture.
That's a good point. Yes, because, I interviewed a numerologist recently on the show who said that we don't really grow up and start to get conscious until we're 55 or 60, mm-hmm. and that's really like midlife because we have now an expectation to live until 120, given her theory. So we're like sort of almost teenagers in a sense right now then.
Or at least in the middle, yes.
or in the middle. So, but that's really, that's a very good point. From a spiritual point of view, we just really have to go for it. Or else, what happens? Do we kind of just have to come back and do it again without the memory of the prior struggles? Do you believe that is what happens?
I haven't gotten that far in my own experience yet. But I certainly believe that we have a choice whether we can open up to what wants to grow and become alive inside of us for as long as we can, or to rigidify and to become afraid and to shut down. And we have to face that choice continually.
I would say that's very well said. I'm speaking with Bud Harris, author of Sacred Selfishness, and we have a whole bunch of you on hold, so we're going to do the best we can to get to all of you. We're going to go to Warren in Los Angeles. Warren, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm listening to it, and it's really great. I had a question for your guest, and that is, I'm a person that I have a lot of things going on right now, like different goals that I want to do, and it's always been difficult for me sometimes to just stick to one thing because, it's like I can't really, I feel that if I concentrate on something too much, I'm neglecting other things that are important as well. and I wanted some advice as to how to get over that and think differently. And I'm a Cancer, and I'll take the answer after the year. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Okay. Cancer, a homebody.
Good. Thank you, Warren. It's a good question. As you may imagine from what I said earlier about myself, I built 12 stores by the time I was 33. So I was a very action-oriented person. I was a person who was always doing, and torn between different ideas. And I spent a good bit of my life that way. What I had to learn to do was to step back and let the side of me that was a seeker emerge a little bit and begin to deepen myself, because then I found out that I was pursuing the things that were of truly the most value to me, which were not always the things that were interesting, because I find more things interesting than I can do. So I have to drop back and find out which ones have real value for my life.
So there's your answer. Okay. Good luck to you, Warren. Okay, we're going to move to Marlene in North Hollywood. Welcome to the show, Marlene.
Hi. Thanks for the show. In my own life, relating to the caller who said about figuring out the living situation, I find myself in my life pulled between two courses. One is to make a home for myself, and then the other is that I want to divest myself of as much physical belongings as possible. That's one question. And then number two, when you mentioned suffering, how does one deal with suffering, like, say, for the soldiers and their families who are dying and the Iraqi people? I mean, I'm these faces of these young people dying and these faces, you know, I find it very hard to handle this pain.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I've had pain in my life.
Mm-hmm. Very good question.
Yes, thank you, Marlene. I find that very painful, too. I find it painful just to see a life that I think has its whole potential in front of it come to an end, whether it's with one of our soldiers or whether it's one of the children in one of the third world countries that is getting killed by some kind of violence or starvation. What I have learned myself is, and I learned this from Joseph Campbell, who used to quote a Buddhist saying, that we have to learn how to live with joy in the midst of the suffering of the world, because all of these things make up the world. And that's not an easy thing to do, and I do it by remembering that saying almost as a mantra. I also have a way myself of ritualizing my grief for some of these specific kinds of sufferings that I'm attached to in some way, because I know people that were involved, like I knew people that were in 9/11, and I have some knowledge of people through my practice that are in Iraq. I have to ritualize my grief for that, and I think that's very important. And I do that by putting my own spiritual emphasis on it. Whenever I feel the need to divest myself of my home and all of my belongings, that's a time when I need to sit back and again look deeper into myself, because I realize what I'm feeling when I need to divest myself is that I have become trapped in some way that I don't understand, and I need to go deeper and I need to understand what's making me feel trapped before I really start selling things.
That's a very good, very, very good question. Two good questions. Thank you, Marlene. We have just a couple minutes left, so we're going to try and sneak in one or two more callers. And Jackie in Long Beach, it's going to be you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have a quick question?
Yes, I do. My question is, how does a person go about surrendering to the universe? And I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, Jackie, those are not words that I would use. I don't use words like surrendering to the universe. But if I were to use those words, surrendering would mean my ego surrendering to my greater self. And that is the process that I outline in the book. And I outline the stages of consciousness we go through, from simple to complex to individual to enlightenment. And by the time we reach the stage that I talk about as enlightenment, our ego has surrendered to the self or the image of the divine or the transcendent within or the universe, however you would like to phrase that is okay with me. But that is a process of development, and it's not something that we can just do like putting on a new shirt. So we have to go through the stages of developing our consciousness that I talk about in the book.
Wow, we are at the end of our hour. Dr. Bud Harris, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Me too. We could talk for hours about this. Sacred Selfishness is the book, subtitled A Guide to Living a Life of Substance. And if you want to find out where Bud Harris will be in Southern California, go to budharris.com, budharris.com. And thank you, Jazz and Master Control today. Monica Donnelly is in production. Christine Blasdale is executive producing. If you have questions about the show, please email me or go to NitaValens2Ls.com, NitaValens.com. Next week, we start Pledge Drive. I have special treats for you. And in closing, remember what the Buddha said. Those who have failed to work toward the truth have missed the purpose of living. I'm Nita Valens. Thanks for listening.